Adrino, this is Rob Adrino, General Quarters, all hands on your battle station.
Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime.
And welcome aboard, everybody. I am the aforementioned Sal, along with my co-host, the ever-genial Eagle One of Eagle Speak. We appreciate everybody joining us today for another edition of Midrats. Though most of you listen on the podcast, we do have an esteemed cohort that joins us live. And if you're with us live, I'd like to extend the invitation for you to scroll down to the bottom of the show page. As usual, we are blessed with Paul standing athwart the quarterdeck to greet you there. And if you have some observations you would like to share during the course of the show, or maybe a question or two you would like for us to address to our guests, that's a great place to put it. We'll be monitoring that during the course of the show, and we'd love to bring your good ideas and observations into the conversation for the next hour. And if you got to take care of some business and you're going to miss part of the show, or if you have missed some previous shows, if you don't already, just go over to iTunes, Spreaker, whatever podcast aggregator you go to, look us up, Midrats, find us, subscribe, free podcast, you can't beat the price, and that way the next episode that we publish will be waiting for you at a time that's more convenient to your schedule. And on today's show, we're going to, obviously, you know, here we are in mid to late April 2022, and everybody is focusing what little white space they have on their head on the Ukraine-Russian war. But today we're going to talk about folks that have been reading my stuff for a few years is what I like to call the long war, and that's the situation in the Western Pacific. And when you look back into the heady days of the 1990s and the post-Cold War view and the New World, the end of history and all that good stuff, back in March of 1996, which might have been pretty close to the high water mark of that one-decade era that existed, there was a national humiliation in the waters around Taiwan that handed to the People's Republic of China from the U.S. Navy. And that caused a lot of, and I remember the reports at the time, everybody thought it was just the best photo op in the world. We really made a point, but we didn't quite make the point that we thought that we had. That put into motion a lot of events and billions of dollars of investment, training, and reorganization for the military structures of the People's Republic of China that has manifested itself into today people's returning concern to the viability of what really is the crown jewel of American maritime power, and that is the utility of the aircraft carrier. Not a new conversation. That conversation has been around a lot for a lot of different reasons. But this time there's a little bit of a different flavor to it. And today we're going to cover that history, the modern implications, and perhaps a few things that people are missing in the challenge, and maybe a few things that people haven't missed but probably should have. And for today, we're going to have for the full hour our guest, Jerry Doyle and Blake Herzinger, and we're going to discuss their recent book titled Carrier Killer, China's Anti-Ship Ballistic Missile and Theater of Operations in the Early 21st Century. And you can find a link to the book over at the show page. Jerry and Blake, welcome to Midrats.
Hey, thanks so much for having us, Sal and Eagle One. It's a privilege to be back with you. And I couldn't be more excited to be, even though we're doing some distributed ops today, sharing the line with my buddy Jerry.
Yeah, thanks so much for having us. I really appreciate you giving us the time.
Well, and just to let the listeners appreciate the sacrifice these gentlemen are making. Well, I don't know if it's really a sacrifice. You might be getting up a little earlier, but they're roughing it with us today from Indonesia and Bali. And, of course, I should have put it in the intro, but I'll do it right now. Their hair is our guest on our podcast, just speaking as individuals, and the opinions they may state during the course of our conversation is just representing their personal opinion and not any organizations they may be associated with now or in the future. And with the lawyers happy, Blake, just going forward from here, I wanted to kind of set the scene because I kind of made the snide comment in the beginning that everybody since February has really been focused, rightfully in many ways, on the events of the Russo-Ukrainian war as they developed. And you didn't pick that. You didn't want that. But it was an interesting time for y'all to come out and try to bring everybody's attention back to where a lot of it was before the Russian invasion. And that has to do with the growth of the ability of China to affect what America might want to do in the Western Pacific. And just to let people know how you and Jerry came to be, talk a little bit about how your collaboration got together and focused on this particular topic.
Sure thing. No, and I think, you know, it's the perfect question. And I think it's a constant battle. It's not just one that we're fighting now to get people to pay attention to the Western Pacific. You know, this is just the latest episode in a long chain of episodes for people seizing whatever they can to not pay attention to the large challenge that we're facing in the Pacific. And obviously this is one that does warrant our attention, but it does make the long slog very difficult. But I actually get a kick out of the genesis of this book because it's actually Jerry's big idea. And he actually emailed me, said, "Hey, look, I'm thinking about writing something about anti-ship ballistic missiles." And when I got that email, I was actually sitting on ESB-3, Lewis B. Puller, in the Persian Gulf, and kind of waiting to see if we were going to be on the receiving end of Iranian anti-ship ballistic missiles. This was shortly after the airstrike in Iraq that killed, you know, our great friend there from the IRGCN. And we were just sort of hanging out, and it was, hey, are they going to use ballistic missiles in theater? And of course they did in the end, against ground-based targets in Iraq of U.S. forces. But we thought at the time that it was very possible that they might target a ship in the Gulf. And so it was a particularly poignant topic to me at the time. Jerry asked me a couple of questions, and I answered, and we kind of went back and forth, and then Jerry very kindly said, like, "Hey, would you be at all interested in working on this with me?" And I was like, "Yes, I am very interested in this topic, and I find it more and more fascinating by the day as I don't get hit with one." But I think Jerry'd probably be the one to say, like, where the idea really sprang from, given he's the font of all knowledge and good ideas.
Well, I wouldn't say all knowledge and good ideas. Maybe most knowledge and good ideas.
Some.
Obviously the stakes were much lower for me because nobody was potentially trying to sink a ship I was on. But from my perspective out here in Asia, there was quite a bit of mystique and discussion about China's anti-ship capabilities in general and anti-ship ballistic missiles specifically, because nobody really knows exactly how well they would work. Obviously, they pose a enormous hypothetical threat to Western navies. And so I just wanted to dig into how big of a deal these were. Was this hype? Was it reality? Is this the type of weapon that really is going to keep the world's navies at arm's length? Is it a wonder weapon or is it just smoke and mirrors? The timing of everything seemed like a really good opportunity to dive into it, really dig into it. And of course, Blake obviously had such a huge amount of expertise and personal interest in the subject. So it all came together. It was a really fun experience to do.
Well, Jerry, let me ask you a question. I know you're in Singapore. I think Sal failed to mention that, and it's Blake who's enjoying himself on the beaches of Bali. But let me help you go through the anti-ship missile stuff that China has. I mean, I think you just hit on it. This isn't an anti-ship ballistic missile is not the only arrow in their quiver, but can you kind of run through what the difference is between the other missile systems they may have, other weapon systems they may have, their anti-shipping and the anti-ship ballistic missile? Kind of give the background for our listeners.
Sure. Obviously, China has a tremendous amount of anti-ship capabilities, and even the idea of an anti-ship ballistic missile isn't particularly new. This isn't something that China has innovated out of thin air. The Soviet Union experimented with anti-ship ballistic missiles back in the 70s and 80s, and those were nuclear tipped because they didn't quite have the accuracy that we do now. But China has thousands of anti-ship cruise missiles. Air launched, surface launch, even submarine launched. And so, bringing an anti-ship ballistic missile into the picture is not something that is necessarily going to, drastically change or, add to China's ability to keep ships out of the South China Sea or other areas around it. But the fact that China has so many other weapons, already made this area very tough to operate in, or certainly give the U.S. Navy and other navies lots of things to think about already. I think the difference is that China has started mounting these missiles sort of farther out, on its sort of man-made islands out in the South China Sea, giving them longer range. And then what the anti-ship ballistic missiles do is expand that range even further, with the DF-26, for instance, being able to stretch all the way out to Guam, giving it the ability to hit shore-based facilities, to hit ships at pier, and even theoretically hit ships while they're on the move. So that's the big difference. China's anti-ship capabilities were always there. What anti-ship ballistic missiles do is try to give them a novel way of hitting a ship with a potentially shorter flight time, less notice, and obviously much longer range. It's also, given technological constraints, it's also more difficult to stop an anti-ship ballistic missile or a ballistic missile of any kind. Whereas, shooting down a cruise missile is more of a known quantity. It's not easy. But there's been decades of research, dating back to the Soviet Union, the Cold War days, when the Soviet Union was sort of expected to volley huge numbers of cruise missiles at a U.S. carrier strike group. And so we spent a lot of time trying to figure out how to stop that. Well, this is where the anti-ship ballistic missile comes in for China. There's been a lot less research into the more difficult problem of shooting down an anti-ship ballistic missile. And so that's why they sort of brought those into the picture.
Yeah, Jerry, and I'll kind of pull the thread.
Sorry.
Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Blake. I'm sorry.
Sorry, I'm stepping on you. The only other thing that I wanted to tack on there is the show page title actually reminded me. China's Assassin's Mace, which is a topic we address in the book. But in terms of China's other ship interdiction methods they have available, the godfather of PLAN research, Andrew Erickson, actually wrote a paper in 2009 about Chinese mine warfare, which they referred to as an Assassin's Mace program. So, we've written, obviously, this book. There's a lot of work about cruise missiles out there. Andrew's done a lot on their missile programs as well. And then, they also have probably one of the largest, if not the largest, mine inventory in the world. In a time, where we have, a handful of very dated minesweepers left and no intent to build more. So just one more element in the whole winter is coming package. So.
Yeah, you can see where they've, and I've said in other venues before, you have to give respect to the continuity of what the Chinese have done here. It's been multi-decade, and I think they've done a very smart job at doing two things. One, they want to get two things done. They want to build a not just a blue water navy, but a global navy that has a global presence, because they are, with depending on how you measure it, the world's number one economy, a number one ocean-going economy. And they want to keep the Americans on their side of the Pacific. And it takes a long time to do number one, but it may take less time to do number two if you can leverage some proven and some experimental technologies. And yeah, the mines are always, heck, we just, going back to the Black Sea again, you know, we saw what just a couple of floating mines near the opening to the Black Sea could do to merchant shipping. That's always an effective thing to do. But Jerry, I wanted to go back to something you mentioned, because I for the listeners who's, if they have a similar problem that I have, it's like, oh, God, another book. How am I going to be able to read it? Y'all did a good job. When you include the footnotes, you've got 70 pages. It's almost an extended trifold that you could see your little media interns handing out at the metro station at the Pentagon if they wanted to. It's very digestible. It's in 70 pages. And in that 70 pages, you brought up a lot of the history and the foundation of this mindset. And the Soviets, they also looked at this challenge of the Americans at sea, and they looked at the anti-ship ballistic missile program. And in many cases, especially when you have modern solid fuel, launching a ballistic missile isn't the hard part. But even with a nuke on the top of it, it's the communicating to it en route and also the terminal targeting end that makes it a challenge that ultimately caused the Soviets to invest their money elsewhere, so to speak. So, you know, Jerry, talk for a little bit about, because what y'all put in your very boiled down data packed 70 pages here is a lot of information that doesn't get past what a lot of the writing is, you know, popular mechanics thick national security discussion of weapons, that there's some physics involved here that makes the second half of the flight profile very challenging for a conventionally armed ballistic missile to be the kind of threat that some people think that it is today.
Yeah, so it is tricky. There's kind of two elements to it that make it a challenging problem for anybody who wants to use a ballistic missile to hit a ship. The first one, as you mentioned, is just the pure sort of physics of it, right? It's not necessarily a difficult problem to launch a ballistic missile precisely at a fixed target. And you know the place on Earth it's going. You know that place on Earth isn't moving relative to the launch position. And so if you know how fast the missile is going and you know what angle you're launching it at, you can pretty well predict where it's going to land, even if you don't have a precision guidance system. You add precision guidance, you know, something with that satellite guidance or even star sighting, you know, as modern ICBMs use as a sort of way of avoiding a technological blackout, you can achieve very high accuracy. Hitting a moving target is much more difficult. Obviously, you know, you can lead a target just like you would, you know, shooting a rifle or a tank gun or something like that. But you know, your target can maneuver, and even just accounting for the flight time of the missile itself, it can be, you know, many nautical miles. Your carrier can be many nautical miles from where it was when you launched the missile. Now, you know, obviously, we're not talking about a ship weaving from side to side, you know, dodging a missile. That's not really what's happening here. The problem physically is that you know, in order to hit a target like that, you sort of have to put the target in the kill basket of the missile, right? The where the seeker is going to look and where it's going to be able to steer the missile once the seeker acquires its target. And then that, in order to get that good effect from the weapon, you have to sort of fire it into the right size. CEP, the probability, I suppose I should say, of where the surface ship is going to be. And the longer amount of time that you have between the firing order and when it arrives, that, you know, that widens the amount of C that the missile is going to have to look at. And so you have to fire more missiles in order to hit the same target. And the second problem sort of ties into the physical problem, and that's ISR. You have to have really good ISR in order to be able to hit a moving target like that. And so you have to have an asset of some kind that's going to give you a sharp targeting solution for your carrier. You know, undersea sensors and over-the-horizon radar can give you a general idea of what you're shooting at, but that's not, it's too big of an area to really effectively aim anti-ship ballistic missile at. You might get lucky. But that's not really what you want to do, is count on luck if you're firing a expensive, unproven, and hugely escalatory weapon at a U.S. carrier strike group. So what you need to do is have a more precise location. You can do that with satellites, which also have their limitations. You might not have full or constant coverage over an area, so you might have to, you know, again, get lucky with the satellite being able to actually spot the carrier. You have airborne assets, which can also provide a precise targeting solution, but are also very vulnerable to the air defenses of the carrier strike group. Surface ships, the same thing. If they're close enough to give you a precise location of the carrier and they haven't been engaged or sunk by the U.S. carrier strike group, well, then the Western Navy has even bigger problems. But then, even if you get that firing solution or that precise location, precise enough location of the carrier strike group, that information has to be transmitted to a decision maker. And that decision maker, the steps between that, maybe it has to go through some sort of political leadership. Again, this is a hugely escalatory thing to directly attack a carrier strike group. And by the time the missile is launched, it could be, you know, many additional minutes, 10, 20, who knows how long, before the missile is actually in the air. And then that widens the area that you have to shoot at. And that leads to the problem of how many missiles you have to launch to hit an aircraft carrier. And, you know, there's actually been some numbers run on this. The U.S.-China military scorecard from 1996 to 2017, which came out a couple of years ago, actually dives into it a little bit. And, you know, nobody publicly is able to say exactly what size or swath of the ocean the missile seeker can look at when it unmasks. But you can kind of crunch some numbers. And if the ratio of the missile's kill radius, how much of the ocean it can see and hit once it unmasks its seeker, to the targeting location, which is obviously the much larger area in which the carrier could be, you know, if the ratio is 0.5, in other words, the missile can see half of the see and hit half of the targeting location of CEP, to get a probability of kill, you know, of 0.6 or 0.8 or something, you're talking dozens of missiles, and that's before taking into account countermeasures and other actions by the U.S. fleet to get out of the way. So it's a very tricky problem from an ISR perspective. And it's not a trivial thing from a physical perspective either, which is, you know, sort of why, to a certain extent, more nations, I think, haven't fielded anti-ship ballistic missiles or land-based ones, So yeah, it's a tough problem, and I think China is still struggling with it.
Well, that it reminds me that Admiral Davidson said that he was aware that they had. I mean, one of the problems is when you're dealing with the motion of a ship, as you've already indicated, is it is a terrible targeting problem. And one of the questions has been over the years, has China tested this against moving targets? And Admiral Davidson said, I don't know, a couple of years ago maybe, that the U.S. was aware that they tested against moving target. But it's unclear from what he said and from other reports that I've seen as to whether or not they were successful in hitting a moving target, or they just successfully managed to launch one of these things so it hit water somewhere. Has there been any update on that information? Have they successfully tested this, or is this just one of those unknowns right now?
Well, I think in concrete terms, in absolute terms, there's no 100% evidence that they've successfully hit a moving target at sea. They've attacked a moving target at sea. They've tested it against that type of scenario. But the thing that is sort of makes it ambiguous about how well things have gone is that there hasn't been any indication, any concrete evidence put forth by the Chinese side to show the effect, to show a hit. Whereas often China and certainly other militaries are not shy about showing a successful test. But this illustrates that this thing that we have that we say can do this thing can actually do this thing. It hasn't been anything like that from China. And the other, I think, bit of circumstantial evidence that China has not gotten this weapon to work precisely the way they want it to, or as well as they want it to, is this sort of cycle of testing. They started on land-based tests, shooting at stationary targets, sort of shaped like ships and shaped like piers in the desert. And then they moved to sea targeting, aiming at targets sort of stationary, barges in the ocean. And then most recently, they tried this test against a moving target at sea. But then after that, they moved testing back on land with sort of a more elaborate testing setup, where they're not just shooting at stationary targets in the desert anymore. They've built these enormous rails that move ship-sized two-dimensional targets through the desert for many kilometers. So they can sort of simulate what a moving ship would be like, albeit on a predictable, sort of S-shaped path. And they're resuming testing in that kind of scenario. And what that implies is that, not that the weapon's a failure, because they're not giving up on it. They think there's a lot of potential there, but that they have not gotten it working precisely the way they want it to. It's not ready for prime time. It's not ready for elaborate propaganda videos, and that they're not ready to sort of present this as a thing that is definitely going to work. The tricky thing is that because we also have not, at least publicly or in an open source realm, seen any evidence that these missiles definitely don't work. And certainly, again, as I mentioned, despite the problems with it, they see enough promise there to continue testing and developing and refining them and building more anti-ship ballistic missile warheads. You can't discount that either. You can't say this is a paper tiger. I think a good sort of parallel example would be the nuclear cruise missile that Russia was trying to develop. And may even still be trying to develop a few years ago, that had some unsuccessful tests and obviously has a lot of questionable operational issues. I don't think anybody in the West is particularly concerned about a fleet of nuclear-powered cruise missiles attacking the Western shore, because it's just not a thing that has been remotely proven to work, and it has so many issues that it's just sort of a something that maybe has a little bit of propaganda value, but no military value. I don't think that's true with anti-ship ballistic missiles or China's anyway. These do have military value. They're just not a proven commodity yet.
So I think there's a great piece in here that sort of hints at, I mean, A, why we named the book what we did, you know, the threat and theater of these ballistic missiles. You know, so much of the value lies in the U.S. Navy self-censoring because we think they work. And if we don't think they work, that we can't discount the fact that they work. And even the last announcement about them, you know, the Chinese have said, yeah, we successfully used them at sea to strike targets during a Chinese joint exercise. And that was in the last days of the Trump administration. And this is a piece that we do mention in the book. But the interesting thing is that that announcement was not from an official PLAN spokesperson. It was not from the CCP. It was actually from a retired general who is also one of the authors of the book Unrestricted Warfare. He's the one who came out and said, yeah, the DF-21 Delta and the DF-26 have been used to strike targets at sea. So it all sort of plays into this cultivated ambiguity that the Chinese have really deftly employed around this to get us to change our behavior and change our the way that we look at operating in Westpac without ever seeing these proven in the wild.
Yeah, cultivated ambiguity is a great...
Go ahead.
Sorry. Yeah, no, I was going to say cultivated ambiguity is an excellent way of putting it. You know, this is the weapon that whether we know precisely how well it works or not, it's the fact that it's there and they're developing it is enough to get us to sort of think twice about it and respond to it and plan for it.
Yeah, it reminds me very much, and when you guys talked earlier about the number of mines the Chinese have, you know, this reminds me of mine warfare. It doesn't matter whether you have mines that work or not, but if you tell somebody you've got a minefield, every sailor knows you've got to respect that idea and have to deal with it until you prove there isn't a minefield. So, interesting point. And I like the theater thing in the title, too, so it's good. All right, Sal, back to you.
Well, thank you. Blake, I want to kind of tie two things together because a lot of the worry and the artwork and all the good stuff that people have invested some time in involves the DF-17. But what things really start get interesting is when you look at the larger and larger, longer range DF-26. And y'all brought up a very good point that has always intrigued me, that if you know you can't do the moving problem, but you're really getting close to solving the fixed problem, and if you know your history and there's a soft way and a hard way of doing it, I think those have been tracking what the Chinese have been doing in the Solomon Islands recently, we'll understand that point, that in order for a nation on the eastern side of the Pacific to create effects on the western side of the Pacific, you have to have a lot of bases. And talk for a little bit about the not just the DF-17, but the DF-26 and what type of shadow that puts under the bases that America, for living memory, has always assumed was a safe place to refit, refuel, rearm, repair, and relax.
You bet. Thanks, Al. Now, this actually ties right into a panel that Rebecca Heinrichs at the Hudson Institute put together recently and was kind enough to invite me to participate. It was about the defense of Guam. And there were some really excellent points made by my fellow panelists. I would say I was more there as a learner, although I do a fair bit of work in Guam. But, you know, the DF-26, you know, is very publicly referred to in Chinese media as the Guam killer. You know, this is not a we don't know why they developed it. I mean, it's pretty clear at this point why that missile exists and why they've aimed for that range, why they've designed for that range. And you're right to look at what is our network of access like in the Pacific anymore. And if you're thinking of anything west of Hawaii, really, Guam is the last real base we have before you get to Japan. And the thing that we depend on Guam for, you know, you could spend an entire new book just writing about all of the functions that we need Guam in order to do in the Pacific. And at the same time, as you mentioned, the Chinese have been whittling away at our access in the South Pacific. And that's, you know, traditionally been the backyard of our allies in Australia, as well as our own. And we've taken a lot of the Pacific for granted for a long time, unfortunately, and created this vacuum that the Chinese feel very comfortable filling. And they're approaching states with, you know, a lot of money and a lot of local investment and, you know, obviously the same kickbacks that they've used in their economic investment everywhere else. And, you know, they're building houses of parliament. They're handing out free stuff. They're building piers. They're building places where maybe the PLAN might want to pull in one day. You know, they're signing security agreements with Solomon Islands. And so at the same time, as they're very loudly trumpeting their capability to, you know, knock the legs out of our most significant base in the Pacific, they're also creating their own network of access, or at least planting the seeds for that access at the same time. And that's something I think we can't take too seriously. You know, there is, you know, there's a long-term problem, and we are way below the power curve in terms of reinforcing our alliances and our access, as well as protecting Guam. And that's something, obviously, that's in the news, a lot of ballistic missile defense. But when you talk about things like the DF-26, as we're, you know, we've seen actually in Ukraine, we've seen ballistic missile use. We saw ballistic missile use in Iraq against us. We've seen it in the Iran-Iraq war. It's not necessarily ballistic missile defense that's going to probably save us. It's digging holes and pouring concrete and creating the operational resilience that we'll need to make Guam survivable in a conflict where ballistic missiles are being used against us.
I just wanted to add one more thing about the DS-26, just from a missile nerd point of view. Blake makes all the right smart points about, you know, what that means for U.S. operations out here. But the other interesting thing about the DS-26 and concerning thing from a Western point of view is it's baked in ambiguity. One of the features of the DS-26 is that it can hot swap warheads. So, you know, sitting in a storage facility without any additional work to the missile, they can, you know, pull off the business end and put a different sort of payload in. So it can have a conventional precision ballistic missile warhead, you know, either unitary or you know, submunition. It can have an anti-ship ballistic missile warhead, or it can have a nuclear warhead. It can use all three of those, or all four of those types of warheads without any additional modifications to the missile. And so with that presents an additional problem to the West, because if you want to do any sort of preemptive strike, if you want to do anything left of launch to prevent an attack by DF-26s, you're presented with the issue that you don't know whether you're attacking a conventional force or a nuclear force. And just as a matter of strategy, any nation that sees its nuclear forces being attacked preemptively is going to be strongly tempted to use them before it loses them. And so it's another sort of thorny issue around this type of system that is completely independent of whether it can hit or whether it can sink an aircraft carrier and makes it more difficult for us, for the West, to plan for how to fight them and how they might be used.
Well, it's an interesting problem. If they start salvoing ballistic missiles and toward carriers, one of our assumptions has to be we've got to figure out whether those things are conventionally armed ballistic missiles and worry about that. I mean, This is a problem for both sides, because if they go unconventional, or we think they're going unconventional, then I would think we would respond to a ballistic missile launch pretty rapidly. All that aside, I mean, we're not defenseless in this. You've devoted a chunk of your book to discussing the ways we can defend ourselves against ballistic missiles, conventional ballistic missiles. You want to discuss that a little bit, because I don't want the listeners thinking that we're sending, might as well paint rubber duckies on the side of the carriers and send them off.
Yeah, certainly not. You know, as I mentioned earlier, the ISR problem is very, very thorny. And that presents that kill chain, the number of steps and the difficulty of steps between finding the ship and hitting the ship. That is the biggest vulnerability of a system like this. And that is where the U.S. and Western navies are probably going to get the most dividends in terms of focusing on disrupting an attack. You know, just sort of starting from the very farthest point leftward of launch, just make it more difficult for your carrier strike group to be seen. You know, that is making sure you have good operational security, sailing in, you know, unpredictable ways, timing your deployments and your maneuvers based on known satellite overpass times, disrupting those undersea sensor networks, making sure that your carrier strike group has, you know, its air defense is energized and is willing to shoot down anything that sort of comes close enough that might be able to perhaps being able to provide a targeting solution. There's also sort of more exotic ways of disrupting an attack. You know, one sort of surprising thing about the war in Ukraine is there hasn't been a whole lot of overt disruption of Ukraine, you know, infrastructure or things like that, you know, certainly military infrastructure by cyber attacks. But that's a capability that Russia put a lot of money into developing. It's obviously a capability that the U.S. has put a lot of money into developing, and China as well. So there would be efforts to sort of disrupt communications, maybe even directly disrupt the weapons themselves, their launchers, their guidance, things like that. Then moving on from there, there's satellites, which are also vulnerable in different ways. You can blind a satellite. You can disrupt it electronically. You can use cyber warfare to try to prevent them from working properly. And there's also the kinetic solution, as it were. You can shoot down satellites. That's a proven capability that China and the U.S. and a few other countries, India and Russia, all have. That presents other very difficult problems of, you know, space debris. And it's also incredibly escalatory. And it's also something that the U.S., I think, might be reluctant to do because it's sort of more vulnerable to this sort of thing than other nations would be by virtue of having many, many more satellites than nearly any other country on Earth. And so, you know, although that's a possibility, it's one that I think the U.S. would avoid except in the most dire circumstances. And then, you know, once the missile is in flight, the problem becomes, or the countermeasures become more conventional. Again, there's still disruption. You can mess with this guidance system on the way up, possibly, if you have access to that. And then once it's coasting along above the atmosphere, it's a ballistic problem. As far as we know, when it's in space, when it's in coasting above the atmosphere, it's not doing any maneuvering at all, right? It is following a literal ballistic trajectory that is defined by its velocity and by its altitude. And when it is in that situation, that's when missile defense systems are most missile defense systems are designed to hit it. Now, modern missiles can deploy all kinds of countermeasures, you know, decoys, you know, jamming, other sorts of things. And missile defense systems are designed to operate around these. But that is when U.S. Air defenses or missile defenses would most likely engage an anti-ship ballistic missile and try to hit it. And then finally, when it's on the way down, the SM-6 does have the ability to hit a ballistic missile in its terminal phase when it's maneuvering in the atmosphere. That capability has not been proven in testing yet that I know. They've not tested the SM-6 against a maneuvering ballistic target. I'm sure that's on the list of things to do as the U.S. prepares for this kind of threat. And then, you know, as it's as a ASVM warhead is, you know, on its final few seconds of its journey, that, you know, the surface fleet has all sorts of point defenses ranging from, you know, the Spanx closing launching system to decoys, to jamming, dazzling, all these things. Again, none of this has been proven against that sort of target. It wasn't designed to defeat that sort of a target, but 100% guarantee that if a carrier strike group is on the receiving end of a ballistic missile strike, every single defense system and countermeasure is going to be thrown at it in order to prevent a hit. So, yeah, as you mentioned, the fleet is not defenseless, and this is not something that the U.S. Navy and other Western navies have been ignoring. Right? This isn't something that's going to take them unaware, and there's been a lot of planning around it. And what remains to be seen on both sides is how well any of it is going to work. And when we find out, it's going to be well. There's going to be a lot of other bigger problems we're dealing with.
Blake, you know, I kind of laughed a bit earlier when my co-host mentioned the rubber duckies, because I remember, I'll date myself a little bit here, you know, back when I was in college in the 80s, I don't know whether it was The Atlantic or The Nation, one of those magazines I would read in the library basement when I had nothing better to do, hiding from ex-girlfriends or something. It had a cover of the U.S. Navy as a bunch of little rubber duckies, and how vulnerable it was. And, you know, back then it was some combination of the Soviets' titanium-hulled super attack submarines and their regiment size backfire bombers. So the vulnerabilities of the carrier is you know, nothing new. And people, and there's a certain subset of people in the national security environment who are looking for any hook to hang the carriers are obsolete. I want to do other things with the money stuff. There are good players with good arguments, and there are other players with other arguments. But one thing that I thought y'all brought out real well in your book is you talked about, and Jerry just covered some of it, there's a lot that needs to happen to locate, track, and attack a moving target at sea. And in each one of those phases, they're not Superman. They're not covered with Teflon. There's lots of weak holes, especially on something that's very bespoke and exquisitely designed like this. Everything has to work just perfectly, or it doesn't. You're just putting a nice show on. And it also played into, it's hard not to have things that have happened in the Russo-Ukrainian war to come to mind, that it takes a long time to build ballistic missiles. This isn't something you can, we're going to build a second production line that's going to be online in 6 weeks. It just doesn't work that way. It takes a long time to do it unless you have an entire nation mobilized. And it almost looks in some ways, you have had this huge inventory you build up over a long period of time, that there might be a subsect of the Chinese national security nomenclature, very similar to the Russian, that convince their leadership we can have a quick war, short war in Ukraine. Our airborne forces with their fancy-dancy T-shirts are going to go into the airport, take the airport. We're going to land all these IL-76s in one load, and we'll seize, and the war will be over in 72 hours. And on the U.S. side of the house, there is a school of thought led mostly by, at least outwardly, by Michelle Flournoy. I think Bob Work has done this as well, talking about how what we need to do is be ready for the 72-hour war, and that will deter China from doing everything. But with that fragility that you show there and the hard reality, not just with the Russia-Ukrainian war, but war in general, that everybody thinks it's going to be a short war but wars tend to have their own timetable that they wind up working on. Is there an inflection point, you think, that the Chinese may have inadvertently invested a lot of time and money in an asset that is scary and might achieve effects in peace that they desire, but may not quite play out as they want everybody to think in war? And like the Russian problem has had, does that lead them to dangerous places?
Yeah, I think that's a fair question on multiple levels. And with regard to the, you know, the carrier is dead, long live the aircraft carrier, you know, if the Chinese thought that building anti-ship ballistic missiles ended the aircraft carrier era, then why are they building aircraft carriers? Right? Like, if they understand the inherent vulnerability of a 100,000 ton ship, you know, a big deck, then why are they building them? So I think that argument's already on shaky legs, but I absolutely think that creating these and then blowing them up, you know, in the media and making them this, you know, it's not just a missile now. It is a symbol of, you know, this entire mythos that surrounds the PRC for the Chinese Communist Party. You know, it's this this magic weapon that will stop, you know, stop us from ever being humiliated again. It will...
I think we lost him.
Well, let me see if I can pick up where he left off while he gets back on. Yeah, I mean, his point is, you know, if this is a weapon that obviates the aircraft carrier, then it's hard to explain why China is building more aircraft carriers. And I also think it's important to note that, you know, first of all, they, as far as I know, they've stopped production of additional DF-21Bs, and they don't seem to be taking them out of service, but they're not making any more. What they are making are tons of DF-26s, and again, that's where that ambiguity comes in. These could be anti-ship missiles. These could be precision strike missiles. These could be nuclear missiles. That works in their favor. They're not putting all their eggs in that basket. This is a missile that has, in theory, the capability to hit a ship, but it also has the proven capability that I don't think anybody doubts to hit a fixed target on land. And that's a great capability all its own. And I also think it's important to remember that even if you take, you know, anti-ship ballistic missiles off the board, China has an enormous sort of conventional or traditional type anti-ship arsenal of you know, missiles that can hit from a variety of different angles, from a variety of different places that the Western Navy already have to account for. And as we saw in Ukraine, it doesn't take much. You know, Ukraine, by all reports, launched two anti-ship missiles using sort of cobbled together ISR with, I'm sure, an enormous assist from the West and NATO countries, and managed to take down a guided missile cruiser. You know, obviously, this is much different theater than the South China Sea. The Russians were operating very, very close to shore with assumptions that they were, seeming assumptions that they were under no threat whatsoever. And I don't think that the U.S. Navy would act in that type of way at all. But it sort of illustrates that it doesn't take a high-end exotic threat to sink a ship. Right? All it takes is a couple of missiles getting through and hitting in the right place. So regardless of how well China's anti-ship missiles are working, they still have this enormous traditional threat to Western navies, and you know that's already giving us tons to think about.
All right. Well, let me. We're getting near the end of our time, but let me ask this question: As we look forward, I mean, we've got the DF-26, longer range and all that. As we look forward, what recommendations would you guys make to protect our assets from these? I mean, other than the defensive weapons we talked about, you know, are there if we went further out, if we went to Wake and Midway and all those places again, does that just mean that the Chinese would extend their range again? Is it, I mean, is this, how much of this is the Chinese tradition of making your enemy act against his own interests sometimes, because you know you raise the threat, whether you have the means or not to deliver it, or it would work, but you know how, but that makes your opponent worry himself into a state of sometimes inactivity. Is there a part of this component that you see, that the theater component you were talking about earlier?
Yeah, well, I think that it's definitely part of the aim of developing a weapon like this is you know, you're giving your adversary something additional to think about, something additional to plan for, and under the absolute best outcome for the Chinese, you're giving them something to panic about and make bad decisions regarding. I honestly don't see that happening. I haven't seen in actual sort of military and defense circles, I haven't seen that sort of panic. I have seen, you know, in terms of commentators, people sort of treating this as a wonder weapon, something like, oh, the U.S. Navy can never operate in the South China Sea now. It's, you know, it wouldn't dare advance beyond the first island chain or whatever. I don't think that's the case. And I think in terms of, you know, larger responses to this, I would think that the West and the Western Navy, they need more ships, not just for air defense, but you know, to be able to operate effectively in general. They need some sort of a proven, and maybe they already have this in terms of undersea capabilities, you know, submarines, some way of inflicting pain on the Chinese Navy without being able to, you know, or without having to advance under, you know, an umbrella of anti-ship missiles. And they have to,
yeah,
you know,
I think,
develop...
I think Subpac thinks they can do that already, right? Sorry, I am back. I think Subpac sees himself as that sword. I think Subpac's ready. But we have to build ships we can lose, right? Like, we have to build ships that we're willing to hazard, which unfortunately we don't have right now. We can't absorb loss. And I think we're seeing what a military that can't absorb loss, you know, we're seeing that with the Russians in Ukraine. Like, they've expended a lot of missiles and bombs, and they've lost a lot of high-end equipment, and that's what a brittle military looks like, trying to fight a war.
And on that note, we're coming up with just a couple minutes left in the show. Again, for folks that maybe are joining us live at the tail end of the show, our guests are Blake and Jerry, and their book is Carrier Killer, China's Anti-Ship Ballistic Missiles in Theater of Operations in the Early 21st Century. And Jerry, let's go ahead and start with you. If people are interested, and not just this, but the other works that you have done, where's a good place they can keep an eye out for you? And what are you and Blake either working with together or separately in the near future?
Well, a good place to look for my work, at least in the defense sphere, would be Reuters. I'm an editor out here for Thomson Reuters, and a lot of what I work on is defense and security related. Specifically, obviously, the big questions out here are, you know, Taiwan, Japan, China, Korea. So that's what I kind of focus on in my quote-unquote day job. And, you know, if you look for my byline or my editing credit, you'll find a lot of that sort of work. I also am, for better or worse, on Twitter offering my often not smart opinions on defense and security matters. And, you know, folks can look for me there, too, and heckle me or give me a pat on the back. In terms of what we want to work on next, well, I mean, that's kind of an open question. You know, China's military capabilities out here, there's a lot more going on, stealth aircraft, new surface platforms, aircraft carriers, and so on, and we'd love to dive into it further.
And I am also on Twitter, more proudly, though. I do try and keep my work pretty current there. Actually, I'm working on a maritime security primer that's being led by John Bradford, but other contributors are, John Odom, Alessio Patilano, who I know is known to our illustrious hosts. And that should be heading to press this year. So I'm a non-resident fellow with Pacific Forum. So, tune into to their work. They do a lot of great stuff. And Pacific Forum is a really great way to get regional voices that maybe don't make it into traditional U.S. Publications or some of the other ones. I think Pacific Forum does a great job with amplifying regional voices. It's been such a pleasure, gentlemen. Thank you again for having us.
Well, it's an excellent book. Excellent book. I recommend it. People read it. Right now, Amazon says it's not available till August, but maybe the Amazon has it wrong. So, and I was going to say, Blake, you still wanting friends with the Army people?
There are a few Army people that have remained my friends. Others, I think, have just blocked or muted me at this point, whether only online or in real life. I still love them. I still love our joint brothers and sisters. Just, as long as they understand that, linchpin might mean something different in the Pacific.
Well, creative friction. If they can't handle it, then they shouldn't be in the game. But, Blake, I just wanted to thank you and Jerry also for coming on. And also to underline the point, and one thing we try to do here on Midrats, is you're right about bringing additional voices into the space. There are some great thinkers with great ideas that I know you run into it all the time, and Jerry, especially over in Reuters, I mean, because you live and breathe this every day. You read somebody and you find out they've been writing good stuff for 5 or 10 years, and you're like, why am I only just now finding these people? So I encourage everybody, if you haven't read somebody new in the last 72 hours, make the effort to. And also for the listeners, if you have somebody who thinks the world is coming to an end because the Chinese have the ability to put a warhead every 20 feet on a carrier deck, please get Jerry and Blake's book. There's a little bit of hard truth there that is good to read. And, gentlemen, I hope you all have a great end of the spring and through the summer, though you're close enough to the equator, it's probably all the same to you.
Sure. Thanks so much for having me.
That it is. Thanks, Jen.
Really appreciate everybody. And thank you very much, everybody, for joining us for another edition of Midrats. Until next time, I hope everybody has a great Navy day. Cheers.
Or you'll be to blame. For love has fairly drove me silly, hoping you're the same. It's a long way to Tipperary. It's a long way to go. It's a long way to Tipperary, to the sweetest girl I know. Goodbye. It's a long, long way to Tipperary.